This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. How the hell are you, Rick?
I'm great. Got through Debbie. Yay! You guys hit the gabber. We're crushing it. I saw your stuff all over social media.
We have a very enthusiastic Gen Z team who gets social media. I'm like the dinosaur moving through everything, like TikTok. We have a TikTok. What's brat mean? It's awkward. It's yesterday they said, well, it's not like you're quite as old as my mom. And I'm like, okay, everybody leave. I don't want to hear. I don't want to be quite as old as your mom. But I am definitely the dinosaur.
Well, it's great to see. Because, you know, we're so landlocked over here, and I'm always wondering how the West Coast of Florida handles that stuff. And you guys are like real time.
Well, so I tell you, it's weird because I live in the north side of Gulfport, which is maybe a mile from the water, and we're on a bay. And I got to tell you, we had a very different storm experience than the people on the water. Like, literally, Sunday afternoon, came back to the house, and I'd gone out to, my mom had been staying with us, and I had driven her home, and it was pretty severe. Like, I had made a point of taking the road that I knew was the highest elevation, and the SUV, not her car. So we did that, came home, and I said, yes, it's just a beautiful day. It's breezy. It's got some great rain. Let's get some pizza, crack open a bottle of wine, and watch TV. And we did. And it was a beautiful night, but not even a mile away, we had 12 boats washed ashore. More running into each other in the bay. One in the channel broke loose, was not supposed to be there, ran into the marina, as I understand it. People went missing who stayed on their boats. One guy died. I mean, it was like two different storms. So it's been wild. It's really been wild. And honestly, after every storm, we do a lot of what I call consequential coverage. We don't forecast. We don't do any of that. We always talk about if you want sandbags, here's where you can get them. Here's where the, if there's shelters open. So anytime, and we do those posts as they happen. And then if there's anything we need to change, you know, in the coverage in between that with the updates. So like the National Hurricane Center does updates at 2 a.m., 5 a.m., 8 a.m., 11 a.m., and then 2, 5, 8, and 11 at night. So if anything changes with that, where they say, you know, usually that's when the cities and counties that we cover will say, well, we're going to open up some more call centers because now it looks like this. So we'll do that. And it's very well received because unfortunately there's not a lot of media outlets doing that. There's not a lot of resources, you know, for everybody. You can of course go to your own city's website if they keep up with it, or maybe they put it on Facebook, or maybe they did it on YouTube, and we just gather everything together so people can come to one place. And people really express that they appreciate it, but it leaves us all feeling like we just need to nap for days. Like, it's exhausting.
Yeah, bad.
And, you know, I know we have more coming, but I hate to say this, we make a lot of money off of our website when there's a storm. And I feel bad. Like, I'd rather make the money because people want to read nice stories about puppies, but it's not how it works.
And, or nice stories about fossils.
Fossils are great stories. You know, I found a great story about fossils. Speaking of our guest, it's kind of funny. A couple of months ago, one of my neighbors who brags about buying fertilizer illegally had reached out to the city and kept complaining about our yard, which is largely native plants, a lot of tall Florida grasses. And the city said, you know, there's nothing wrong with her yard. Like, this woman is like the Gladys Kravitz of the neighborhood. And so I got kind of pissy, and we have a pole bird feeder that kind of faces her yard across the street. So I went through the process and got my yard certified as a National Wildlife Federation yard, and we paid for the big sign, and we went out and put the sign on the bird feeder, so she looks across and sees it like a certified habitat, because I can be a little bit of a bitch. But with that,
not a good segue.
No, it is. I can be a bitch. But no, the point of that is, with that, I didn't realize I got a magazine subscription to National Wildlife. And the summer issue is, first of all, adorable. It's got this beautiful picture of the kelp forests in California with an otter, who incidentally is probably much larger than the otters we have in our freshwater in Florida. So I picked it up and I took it. My husband and I went to Central Florida just for a weekend to sit in a hotel and not do anything because it's been a summer. And I brought the magazine and I'm flipping through it and I'm very, 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 very Florida centric. Like, it takes a lot for me to stop and read an article in any of these magazines. It is not about Florida. I get the Sierra one, the Nature Conservancy, National Wildlife, and I like go through and I look for the Florida because I don't know, it's my brand. And there is this great article in there, and I'm reading it on the way out to the hotel in Orlando traffic. My husband's driving, obviously. And I'm like desperately looking for the author's email address. I'm like, we have to have this woman on the podcast. It's going to be fantastic. And so we do today. We have Stephanie is the author, and Stephanie wrote this wonderful, Stephanie Livingston, I presume, wrote this wonderful article about this elephant graveyard that they found in Florida. That's how they describe it in the article. There's a little bit more to it than that, but it just captivated me. And so I have done enough talking. I think it's been like a full 8 minutes of me talking now, and I'm sure people are bored. So I'm going to go ahead and say welcome, Stephanie. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Hi, Kathy, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Are you a big fan of fossils? I mean, how did you find this article? Because you, if I understand correctly, are not a paleontologist, right?
I'm not a paleontologist. I'm a freelance science journalist.
How did you find the story? This is fantastic. And tell people about the story, please.
Sure. So again, I'm a freelance science journalist. I've spent much of my career exploring sort of how scientific research intersects with real world challenges and finding solutions to those challenges, particularly in the context of climate change and conservation and wildlife. And I actually got my start as a community newspaper reporter, just reporting in rural areas of North Florida and farming communities. And that's actually kind of how I was introduced to prehistoric Florida, is through just amateur fossil hunters and reporting on, you know, mastodon finds, like mastodon teeth that amateur fossil hunters were finding in the Suwannee River and things like that. So yeah, when I found out about this new fossil site discovered in Williston, Florida, and also found out that it's at the site of an ancient riverbed, I was like, oh, that's so cool, because I actually grew up on the Suwannee River. I'm, you know, lifetime Floridian. And yeah, it just really, it fit with what I do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have, as I think most people prone to wandering around Florida outside do, I have jars of shark's teeth, right? I love to go down to Venice Beach, look for shark's teeth. And I know there are these great stories of fossil hunters who have found mammoth bones and all these things. And in fact, I want to have on the podcast a guy in the Tampa Bay area who is a diver who has been attacked by an alligator while he was diving for fossils, and he fought off the alligator, and he comes out to do these talks and he's got trays of these giant fossils. I'm not that person. I think if I ever found a real fossil, my first instinct would be to like call the state and be like, I found it. And it would probably be like, ma'am, that's a dolphin nose bone. You're going to be fine. And that was kind of how you explained this find initially in the story, right? Like the state, whoever said, yeah, people are always finding stuff, but then it was something. So tell us about what they found.
Yeah, at first, you know, no one was too excited. People find fossils in Florida all the time. And this particular site was discovered by a little girl a five-year-old who was just digging in the dirt on her family farm and found some really interesting fossils. And one of them turned out to be a gompathir bone, which is an ancient elephant that we had here in Florida.
I was wondering how you pronounce that.
Gompathir, yeah.
Gompathir, okay.
Yeah, and they're just like these really strange creatures. Like it's an elephant, but it has four tusks. And yeah.
Was it mean?
Actually, from what the experts told me, they were really fantastic mothers and fathers. You know, one of the elephants at the site was found with a lot of juvenile and infants around it. So, you know, one could, you know, assume maybe they died at the same time trying to cross the river, and the, you know, adult elephant was trying to help its children cross or something like that. It's kind of tragic.
Oh my God, that's horrifying. Yeah, kind of I mean, tragic. How old are these fossils?
These fossils are 5.5 million years old.
Oh, so, my God.
I mean, honestly, they'd probably already be dead at this point, but it just, it's so heartbreaking. Like, it's just these stories. I love to find these stories. I hate them, but I love to find them. These stories like that, where you found the mother taking care of the young, or the people who perished in Pompeii holding on to each other. I mean, I don't know why. I think it gives some humanity to some of the fossils.
Definitely kind of the animal equivalent of that situation. But, you know, as I pointed out in the article, it also speaks to the freedom that these elephant ancestors had, just the freedom to roam wild and make the decision to cross the river in search of vegetation on the other side, or whatever it might have been.
So let's talk about that, because that's the thing about the article. It was a little bit interesting. It wasn't simply an article that's like, hey, here's this really cool fossil find. I know to our listeners, it probably sounds like that's what I keyed on, and that's true. But the article was actually the headline, and we'll include a link to it in the show notes. It's called Lessons from Elders. And it talks about the fact that these prehistoric creatures lived in a warming climate, and that there are some takeaways for now. But so I mean, obviously, from what I understand of what we know, the climate was not warming quite as quickly as perhaps it is now. But yeah. There's some takeaways, not only for elephants either, right?
Yes, for sure. You know, one of the significant findings, or one of the things researchers can dig into when it comes to gompathir fossils, is just the role in understanding the effects of climate change when it comes to large herbivores today. So fossils reveal that, you know, as the climate shifted into historic times, these, you know, ancient relatives of elephants had to adapt to the changing environment, which included, like, you know, alterations to vegetation and water availability, just like elephants are facing today. And researchers can kind of can look into, you know, what this led to. How did they adapt? How did they change their diet? How did their teeth even change over time? And, you know, these changes happened over hundreds of thousands, even millions of years. And that's not what's happening today. I mean, these changes, you know, climate change today is happening in the matter of decades and centuries. And elephants may just not have time to adapt.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you, is how long do we know how long it took for these creatures to adapt? And
Yeah, I think that's something that's still being studied, but it takes a very long time. Definitely, you know, millennia.
Yeah, and we don't have that right now.
Exactly.
But so can you talk to about, I mean, people think of Florida, and I don't think they think about elephants in Florida, but essentially that's what we're seeing here, is there were elephants in Florida. And not just down at Ringling, which I don't think they use anymore, but you get the point. Like, what other types of fossils have been found from this time period?
So they call the site Mount Brook, and it was basically the bend in a river. So it was where, like, trash and debris got stuck, and also lots of bones. possibly from animals falling into the river or trying to cross the river, or even flooding that happened. And then as the water washed through the bend in the river, it kind of congregated there. And they have found just everything that existed in the area that would have come near the river to have a drink, you know, everything from deer to rhinoceros, like these really crazy rhinoceros that had like these stubby little legs. They were actually kind of cute.
As opposed to their graceful statuesque legs that they have now.
Shorter and stubbier.
It's so adorable.
Are they still taking bones out of the site, or have they dug everything up?
No. So I think this is the 9th year. And when I visited last year in 2023, it was actually on their 8th anniversary of digging at the site. And it is just crazy how many fossils they're taking out of this place. I actually got to visit one of their warehouses where they're storing all of the fossils. And it's just, it's the cabinets are full. There's boxes on top of the cabinets, just stacked on top of each other. Like they're taking so much out of the place. It will take decades to study it all.
How come I'm just now hearing about this? I mean, this was a significant find, right?
Yes, and it was on private property. So I think at first there might have been some concerns about that, and just, you know, making sure it was protected before, you know, speaking it to the public too much.
I think I heard about it, but I'm often up in Gainesville watching the local news up there because it's near Williston, which is one of the areas near Gainesville. So are there any of these on display at the museum in Gainesville, or are they all in the warehouse, any of the bones?
I think there's been some talks about, you know, maybe one day displaying a Gompa there, but I'm not sure if that's actually happening. You would have to ask the museum about that.
Oh, I would love to see a Gompa there. I said it, Gompa there. Feels good. Say it, Kathy.
Gompa there.
Yay.
I'm so proud of you, Rick. Gompa there. I keep wanting to go gomp, gomp. Do you know, Stephanie, have they collected enough to recreate an entire Gompa there? I mean, do they have enough fossilized bone of that?
So I guess about a year before I began reporting this piece, they found a near complete Gompa there, which I talk about in the article, along with several juveniles. So yes, they have a near complete Gompa there, and it was huge. It took a backhoe to get it out of the ground, and just tons of people to, you know, lift it out and get it back to Gainesville.
So how big are we talking here?
We're talking about the size of, I guess, an Asian elephant, I think. So they died.
So those aren't quite as big as African elephants, right?
Not quite as big.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they're not like giant dinosaurs, but they're still pretty dang big.
Yeah, they're like 20 feet long, aren't they?
20 feet? I'm not sure if they're quite that big.
I mean, they're not rhinoceros sized.
I want to say about 8 feet tall ish.
Wow. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be disturbing to me. Me paddling down the Suwannee River and I see an 8 foot tall elephant just, you know, packing his trunk with water, I'd be a little freaked out. And this is along the Suwannee, right? I mean, essentially, this is part of the Suwannee River Valley.
That's right. So I'm Googling and it says up to 9 feet tall for an Asian elephant. So.
To 9 feet tall? Yeah. I mean, I don't want to see that. I mean, I kind of want to see it. it's really interesting to me because we're so, Florida is dolphin and shark and fish. And of course, now people know about the panther and the black bear, but we don't think about having large animals in Florida. And this is definitely a large animal. And I love the idea that also there might have been rhinoceros. Well, there were rhinoceros.
Mm-hmm. And other things like hyena dogs and giant sloths. Creatures, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did we have mammoths and mastodons? Because I get confused. You know, I think of woolly mammoths as those things that, you know, had the long hair and they find them in Siberia. And mastodons are slightly, like, I get all confused. I know, did we have both or just one?
Yes, we had both at different times.
Okay.
We had both.
I know that they're finding stuff. They've found artifacts at Silver Springs and at Wakulla, big tusks, and their teeth are often found. And I've seen their teeth, which brings me to another question. Is it legal if you say you found a big mastodon tooth as an individual, are you allowed to pick it up and take it with you, or is that legal?
Oh, that would be a question for the museum.
Honestly. Okay.
Do you have a specific reason you're asking there, Rick?
No, my understanding was, I think I was with Captain Karen and we were at the drawdown on the Ocklawaha River, and she said you cannot touch archaeological artifacts anymore. They have to be left on site. And I know when I was a kid, we used to pick up pottery shards all the time. And we, like you talked about, boxes or jars of shark's teeth. We had boxes of Timucuan Indian pottery because back then, we didn't know how rare it was, how special it was. And as far as I know, there wasn't any laws against picking it up. But I think you're not supposed to. And it might be different between archaeological and paleontological or whatever. Yeah. I don't know.
And it might also be different between public lands and private lands.
Maybe.
So it probably depends. But
so sure. the site near Williston, can we just go walking up and see it, or is that off limits?
It's on private property, but you could contact the museum about volunteering. But I do think they have a wait list at this time, last I heard.
Always wanted to do that. That's on my life list, to be somebody there with a little paintbrush, dusting stuff off and watch it slowly emerge and putting it into that sifting thing. Have you ever been to a dig, Kathy?
No. I feel like I've really not lived.
You don't think about that a lot of times in Florida, do you?
Well, that's the thing. I think about fossils other than shark's teeth. I mean, I guess I've been on a dig if it counts sifting through the sand at Venice Beach, which apparently is illegal now. If it doesn't count that time breaking the law, yeah, I'd have. No, I always, you think Montana.
Yeah.
But I haven't been, and I should.
I've participated on a couple of digs. I actually got to cover a Tamuqua site. And now, Mount Brook, and I'll tell you, it's just so hot.
Yeah, it didn't look like there was any shade at all. Where was the Tamuqua site, if you're allowed to say?
It was on Amelia Island. Mm. Yeah, I was out there. Wow.
She could tell you more, but she'd have to kill you, Rick.
Well, it's sad that a lot of those places, the Rochelle middens up and down the St. John's River, a lot of those were destroyed and used for roadfill. So I always say sometimes in my talk that, it's possible there's artifacts that were in the roadbed that you drove here on that were once part of a shell midden. And we just don't know because they didn't. I mean, in the 19th century, there were archaeologists who went and did digs and found all this stuff. But at some point, they just decided, let's just use it for roadfill.
Well, and, there's also those artifacts should not be at the Florida Museum. They should be back with the descendants of those people, which would be the Seminole Tribe of Florida, the Miccosukee. And they just actually had Seminole Tribe of Florida led a campaign about repatriation of these artifacts called No More Stolen Ancestors. And they got the Smithsonian to change their policy, which is incredible. But it goes back, Indiana Jones, when it's a famous line, it belongs in a museum. No, it doesn't. It belongs back with the descendants of the people. I mean, there's a lot of politics around artifacts that are found now too. So, we're talking about animals in this podcast, right? So that's different.
Yeah, you've gone far afield a little bit. I did find another article that Stephanie wrote that I would like to ask about Turtle Mound, which is here in Central Florida at the Cape Canaveral seashore, which if you visit there, it's hard to see much because it's so grown over.
Yeah. It's a nice hike.
Yeah.
Not too much. You can see some of the shell midden.
Oh, so there's area you can actually see some of the cross section?
Some of that, yeah, you can see some of it, but it's mostly grown over.
Yeah. And so it's hard to get a sense of just how enormous it is, but it's one of the larger ones existing, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. And so it's at risk from climate change?
Yes, I know there's been some teams out there, some researchers, you know, trying to mitigate sea level rise in that area. But you can only do that for so long.
In Florida. Yeah.
We've already lost some of our shell mounds.
So it could be an island at some point. Just stick the only thing left sticking up.
Yeah, erode into the sea.
So do you know the name of the culture that created that? Because that was on the coast. So I don't think it was Temuco. Was it the ice or is that too far? I always get confused by all these people. Or was it the Temuco? I guess it was the Temuco.
Let's see.
There's so much, I'm fascinated by the early indigenous people who lived in the state of Florida. But, you know, one of the challenges for me is keeping up with all of it, because it seems like we're learning so much so fast that unless you're an academic and you have access to academic journals, it's difficult to stay on top of all that. And it seems like, if I were to do it over and to go, you know, through grad school and all that stuff, it might be an area I'd like to study, because we're kind of changing and shifting the way we look at it so much, like what Kathy talked about with the remains, the human remains.
Everything's changing, right? I mean, yeah. And you talk about, yeah, unless you're an academic and have access to those journals, which are typically not interesting. Like they really, in a journalism sense, they really bury the lead with a lot of that shit that they write. Like they're not, it kills me. I'm like, you just did this whole thing. And at the end you mentioned, you know, like we had four heads 20 years ago or something.
That's wild. Science journalists.
Yeah, that's right. We need people like Stephanie to interpret.
That's why we need, absolutely.
We need to support journalism, especially science journalism.
It's, well, science. If we had paid more attention to science journalism historically, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation right now. But that's, you know, I feel like we have not a lot of newspapers, unfortunately, have a full budget for a science journalist, which is why you're a freelancer, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the newspaper I originally, you know, got my start with is no longer in existence. Like so many newspapers in Florida, and, you know, and some of the areas where I used to report, it's just a news desert now. There are no newspapers.
Yes. Well, we bought a newspaper that was closing, and it's, you know, we have no money to pay reporters. Like, I mean, we pay reporters. We actually do pay our two staff reporters better than I think the state average, but the freelancers, I feel bad for. Like, I always feel bad for the freelancers. But, you know, we have to keep the paper going. So we do what we can. And science journalism, we do have one guy who has written a few articles for us. He's wonderful. And they're very well received. I mean, he wrote an article about living croc safe in Florida, and it was one of our top read stories for a month. People really enjoy reading about the world around them, the natural world around them. So it's you know, it's fascinating to me. I'm glad to see it's fascinating to other people, and I'm glad to see that it's still a thing that's happening. Yeah. That there is science journalists. What else are you working on?
Oh, right now, I'm working on an Everglades story. I cannot say much about it, but it's an invasive species story, so you can probably figure out.
Does it have legs?
The story has no legs.
I can't say more, Rick, but it will be out. It will be out this fall.
I see a cool story about the Suwannee where you talk about alligator snapping turtles, which are one of my favorites. I live on a little lake and we have a big snapping turtle. It's not an alligator snapping turtle, but we talked about it last week, how they're like dinosaurs. And I find myself, as the artistic side of me, becoming more and more obsessed with turtles. I just love turtles. And can you tell us about the story about the Suwannee and the alligator snapping turtle that you wrote for the Marjorie?
Oh, sure. So that was just a personal essay that I wrote about, basically, kind of my worries, I guess, for the future about people who live along rivers in Florida. We're actually seeing the Suwannee rise as we speak right now due to Debbie, and there's impending flooding expected along the rivers up in North Florida. And to say there's not a climate change connection to all of this and to these, I mean, there definitely is. We know that experts have told us there's a connection between monster storms and climate change for, decades now. And I think this area of Florida, where I grew up, is sort of a part of Florida that's sort of forgotten when we talk about Florida, period, and when we talk about climate change in Florida and how it's affecting the people here. Even as the storm Debbie was rolling in, I was watching some news coverage, and the newscaster said, thank goodness it's hitting this part of Florida and not a more populated area. And I'm just thinking, my family lives there, my friends, there's multiple rivers that will certainly flood after the storm hits. This area of Florida just experienced Idalia a year ago, and with massive tree damage and damage to homes and mobile homes. And now just a year later, they're experiencing another storm, and Idalia was actually as far as I know, the worst storm to hit that area in decades, probably the last century. I've never seen a storm come through Suwannee, Hamilton, and Madison County and just, rip up oak trees the way this one did and cause this type of destruction. And now, here we are again. And we saw during Hurricane Michael how slow authorities were to help. And it was the same reaction during Michael, during Idalia, during Debbie. It was, thank goodness it didn't hit a more populated area. And I
That's a
think,
really insensitive, stupid thing to say.
right. And I think we kind of, I mean, these are rural people. These are very resilient, tough people. These are farmers. These are blue collar workers, who live in this area. And I think we take their resiliency for granted. The fact that, I know during Idalia, like within days, the roads were cleaned up, and it wasn't. It wasn't the county or the state cleaning the roads. It was the local farmers and just people getting out with their own tractors and clearing the roads. And I think we kind of take it for granted that, if they start experiencing these types of storms, intense storms every year, that's going to take its toll. They're going to need help.
Well, and I just say this too. I did an article about the Toria tree after Hurricane Michael, because the Species Survival Plan, the SSP for the Toria tree, was concerned with fire, and they had no provisions really for high winds. And Hurricane Michael came through, made landfall in the Panhandle as a Category 5, went over the rest of the state as a Category 4, which was unheard of in this part of the Panhandle in Bristol. And you say, yeah, thank goodness it didn't hit a more populous area. The other side of that is it's now hitting an area where people don't have appropriate coverage for hurricane. They don't have the wind deductible. They don't have that. I went through the April after Michael came through, and I was horrified by the number of homes that still had tarps for roofs. So, I mean, it's not okay to say send it to a less populous area, because in the more populated areas along the coast, we are taught how to prepare. We grow up with it. We have the insurance for it. I mean, these people are not. That's a horrible thing to say. Was that a television news station? Yeah. Well, they're stupid
I heard a
sometimes.
lot of that even through by, national news. during Idalia. It was, you know, Florida was spared. I think that was actually the headline. I'll have to find it. Florida was spared.
And that is unprecedented bullshit. We were not spared.
As you know, and that was as, you know, some of my friends had trees through their mobile homes. And I mean, that's like saying, you know, thank goodness this storm hit Florida's most vulnerable area and, you know, most low income area.
That's horrible. That really, I'm sorry, that, I mean, people are stupid. And I understand that without humans in the way, hurricanes are wonderful things, right? If we don't build or live somewhere, the hurricane is great for the natural system of things, but we're here. So yeah, it's okay. Yeah. I'll stop. I'm going to get up on a soapbox. I won't stop.
Let's go back to talking about the Suwannee, because I just thought about, you know, what you said is that, a lot of the, you know, the water comes from further north and it hasn't made its way down here yet, and it will, and it'll peak and it'll brown out all the springs. And if the water sits there a lot of long enough, that tannin stained water will actually hurt the vegetation around the springs. That happened at, on the Santa Fe at, Blue Springs, Gilchrist Blue Springs, where, you know, the brown water blocked all the light out and everything died, and it has taken years for it to regrow. And how devastating that is to all the ecology of the spring, because all those turtles and the fish all need that aquatic growth in order to survive. And that, do you think that's likely to happen along the Suwannee?
Oh goodness, I'm, you know, I'm not an expert, but you know, I think history shows us that that's probably likely.
Hopefully the water will pass through quickly, because it drains into the Gulf, and that won't happen. But I imagine all the springs are browned out around the Santa Fe and the Suwannee now, I would think, with all that surface water.
Not feeling too spectacular, y'all.
Well, fossils are cool. We could swing it back to around that. I mean, I remember one of the things when we were collecting pottery shards is I found this little jawbone, and I grew up in Gainesville, so I was able to go to the museum, and was dying to know what it was. And I had an actual, I don't know, archaeologist or paleontologist or some kind of scientist in the museum say it was a fossilized otter jawbone. And to me as a kid, to find that, it was like, I still have it actually. It's just this teeny little thing with a tooth in it. That was such a rush. Is there places where kids can still do that? I know that there's fossil hunting along the Peace River, but if you were to want to try and legally collect fossils, is that your best bet, you think? Have you done that, Kathy, the Peace River?
I have done the Peace River. I didn't know if you were asking me or Stephanie.
I was asking you both, sorry.
I don't know if it's legal, but I have, many of my shark's teeth have also come from the Peace River. And I, when I was a kayak tour guide, would take people down there kayaking. We'd do day trips. And, you know, the joke was always that people were always finding where they would always be like, look at this. And these people would go on these kayaking trips and they would be like, oh, this is, I can tell that this is a dolphin ankle bone or whatever, you know, but there's tons of fossils down there. I have no idea if it's,
I think people still do it. I've seen it on that television show, How to Do Florida. And so I think that must be legal for some, you know, and the big thing is the megalodon teeth. Everybody's looking for the giant megalodon teeth. That would be a thrill. Do you know any about any other places, Stephanie, where you could go hunting? In Gainesville, we used to go to Rattlesnake Creek and find shark's teeth. That was the big place.
Yeah, anywhere there's a creek in Florida too. Creeks and near springs. Yeah. And you know, actually growing up, I grew up near a phosphate plant. And I used to, like, they would like give sand and stuff to locals. And I used to dig through the sand and find shark's teeth, which was one of the things that got me interested in the fossil, which is kind of a strange juxtaposition, because the phosphate plant is also what got me interested in environmental issues. So, yeah.
In Mulberry down in Polk County, they have a big museum, and they dump all the dirt in and let the kids dig through it and look for fossils. They still do that today. And because they, you know, there's as part of the museum, they've had skeletons of mastodons or mammoths again on display and all that cool stuff that they find in there. So that time when there was all these critters running around, was Florida, you know, the much larger than it was? Because I know that there was a time when the Ice Age started to end when Florida was really huge.
So, you know, actually what I was told is that it was smaller.
So maybe it's changed twice. It's been smaller.
It depends on
larger.
Where it depends on
the time.
So like if we're looking at 5.5 million years ago and the Mount Bernard, the ocean was actually very close by.
Wow.
Kind of near a delta, and they've actually found a lot of shark fossils.
Not just the teeth?
Mostly teeth.
Oh, got excited for a minute.
I think we're going to need to get a geologist in here. This is blowing my mind that the coast was actually near Williston. Because I know...
nearby, and they found saltwater species.
Wow. Because I also know it was wider at one point, too, but I think that was more recent in time. Ah.
Okay.
I have to bone up on my science here.
On your different epics, yes.
Yes, I guess so.
Stephanie, you've been incredibly generous with your time and your knowledge, and thank you for writing these types of articles and being on the podcast with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for those of you listening, we will definitely, I'm working on the show notes throughout the show every time. We have the link to the National Wildlife article, the Florida Museum's treasure trove of articles about Montbrook, and Stephanie's website and her Instagram. So definitely lots there. Hop over to the show notes, read about the turtles that Rick mentioned, all that kind of stuff. Thank you both for your time today. Thank y'all for listening. And we'll see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.